There is no relaxing in the Middle East.
Apparently, Israeli security forces believe that an attack could be happening in the next 24 to 48 hours.
Plus, the Prime Minister of Bangladesh resigns and flees the country.
Escalated because of mishandling by the government, by the absolute arrogance of the political leadership, by excesses of the security forces, into something which was so angry and demanded that the Prime Minister stepped down.
And later, anti-immigrant riots in Britain, F-16s in Ukraine, and is there an economic crisis headed our way? Today is Monday, August 5th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The United States, other Western countries, and Jordan are telling their citizens to leave Lebanon. So dire is the warning that the U.S. Embassy in Beirut will loan American citizens money to get out if they're unable to withdraw enough from the bank, as there are limits on cash withdrawals. All this as Washington deploys additional military hardware and personnel to the Middle East. The White House describes the move as defensive amid fears of an Iranian military strike on Israel. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports.
U.S. warships and fighter jets are on their way to the Middle East to deter an all-out war and, in quote, defense of Israel. White House Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week.
The Pentagon is moving significant assets to the region to prepare for what may be another need to defend Israel from an attack, while simultaneously we are working very hard to de-escalate this situation diplomatically, because we do not believe that a regional war is in anyone's interest in the current moment, and that is something that we've been trying to avoid since October 7th.
The show of military might comes amid rapidly soaring tensions in the region following the assassination of top Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran last week, and a rocket strike on Israel's Golan Heights area that killed a dozen children on a soccer field days before. Israel blamed the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah for the attack and struck what it said were Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. A Hezbollah commander was killed. Both Hamas and Hezbollah are backed by Iran. Israeli military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari.
Hezbollah's ongoing aggression and brutal attacks are dragging the people of Lebanon and the entire Middle East into a wider escalation. While we prefer to resolve hostilities without a wider war, the IDF is fully prepared for any scenario.
But in Beirut, on footage carried by the Hezbollah-controlled Al-Manar TV, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah denied the group's involvement. Nasrallah on Al-Manar TV as provided by AP.
We categorically deny our responsibility of this incident, and we have the courage to take responsibility if we bombed a place, even by mistake.
Despite the finger-pointing, there are real-world consequences for people living in the region. Israel's Iron Dome air defense system triggered over the weekend to intercept attacks from across the border in Lebanon. And with military reinforcements on the way, the State Department issued a do-not-travel advisory for Lebanon, encouraging U.S. citizens to depart. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
As we've heard, tension in the Middle East has ratcheted up to what could be an all-time high. For a look inside Israel as they expect the bombs to start falling soon, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, you know, Israel has been sort of preparing for an attack. There have been some clashes with Lebanon. There was a terrorist attack in which two older Israelis were stabbed to death yesterday. And mostly there's just a lot of tension.
And that's between Lebanon, Hezbollah, and northern Israel.
Yes, yes. But in addition, Israel is sort of waiting for an attack by Iran after the alleged Israeli assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran last week. And the reports in the Hebrew press say that Israel might consider a preemptive attack on Iran if they're sure that Iran is planning an attack on Israel, which they seem to be doing based just on all of the rhetoric. And apparently Israeli security forces believe that an attack could be happening in the next 24 to 48 hours.
And they believe that attack to be coming from Iran and not one of its proxies.
Well, probably they're talking about a joint attack that would be both Iran directly, like happened in April, but they say it will be more significant, and also from Hezbollah and perhaps also from the Houthis in Yemen simultaneously, which would also really challenge Israel's air defenses.
And that's got to be a really unsettling feeling for the Israeli population to know that an attack is coming without knowing when or where.
Yes, it is very unsettling. There's something called the Home Front Command, and they're the ones that issue sort of the orders about whether people are allowed to go about their normal business and things like that. And they said, as of now, there is no change in those orders. In Haifa, which is believed to be one of the targets that Hezbollah would hit because it's relatively close to the border with Lebanon, they've apparently moved some hazardous chemicals away, fearing that if there was a rocket attack that hit some of the industrial areas, all these different plants there, that these hazardous chemicals could spread. Other than that, there's not panic. Nobody's panicking, but there's definitely an unsettling feeling. People are buying generators. People are buying water. I actually went to the supermarket this morning to buy water, to buy a 6-pack of water for our safe room, which is the bomb shelter that's in every Israeli apartment or in older buildings in the building itself. And I'm not at all kind of hysterical or anything like that, but I bought water and we did put an emergency light in there.
Now, you said it was an unsettling feeling, but I'm sure Israelis know that it's a direct result of attacks in Beirut and the alleged attack in Tehran. Is there a sense that it's worth it, that the two assassinations, or one and alleged other, are worth this unsettling feeling for the attacks against Hezbollah and Hamas?
Most of the people that I spoke to said yes, they think it's worth it. Certainly, you know, the guy in Lebanon, the Hezbollah guy, was not well known in Israel. But Ismail Haniyeh, again, that one Israel has not officially taken responsibility for, unlike the one in Hezbollah, which they did. Ismail Haniyeh is, you know, known as one of the senior leaders of Hamas, and Israel has been saying all along that it will get to everybody who was involved in October 7th, and that includes Ismail Haniyeh. So I think, you know, also people, a lot of Israelis feel that what happened on October 7th, when thousands of Hamas gunmen just kind of managed to get across the border with no one stopping them, take over several dozen Israeli communities, kibbutzim, which since then have been evacuated. The border with Lebanon has been evacuated since then. So there was a sense among a lot of Israelis that it's Israel's deterrence had suffered a really heavy blow. And the fact that Israel can assassinate this guy in Beirut and allegedly assassinate Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, I think most Israelis, even those on the left, are supportive of this and feel that Israel needs to reestablish its deterrent posture, and that they're prepared, you know, nobody wants a full-scale war, but they're prepared for some sort of Hezbollah response. And then depending what happens with that, there could be an Israeli response to the Hezbollah response. And that's what the United States and other international actors are trying to kind of calm things down.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, as always, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for your time.
Sure. Thank you, Steve.
The other top story of the day takes us to South Asia, where Sheikh Hasina, the Prime Minister of Bangladesh, has resigned and fled the country. That's the sound of a helicopter flying over Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. In it is former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina. I say former because she resigned earlier Monday and fled the country as more people were killed in some of the worst violence since the birth of the South Asian nation more than five decades ago. Local media is reporting that she's landed in Agartala, the capital of India's northeastern state of Tripura. Though we cannot independently verify that at this time, Bangladesh has been engulfed by street protests and violence that began last month after student groups demanded an end to a controversial quota system for government jobs. That escalated into a campaign to seek the ouster of Hasina, who won a fourth straight term in January in an election boycotted by the opposition. A massive crowd of protesters stormed Hasina's official residence on Monday, shouting slogans, pumping their fists, and showing victory signs amid her resignation. This protester is proudly saying that they're declaring an end to 16 years of autocracy. Crowds were seen in drawing rooms of the Prime Minister's residence, and some people could be seen carrying away televisions, chairs, and tables from what was once one of the most protected buildings in the country. Manikasha Ganguly is the Asia Deputy Director for Human Rights Watch.
They will feel that they have won today because a lot of people have lost their lives in this fight, which really began peacefully only over quotas in government jobs, but escalated because of mishandling by the government, by the absolute arrogance of the political leadership, by excesses of the security forces, into something which was so angry and demanded that Prime Minister stepped down. So they will be happy today.
Even as protesters might be happy that Hasina has stepped down, there is still a lot of work to be done to rebuild the country. Again, Manikasha Ganguly.
These last three terms of the Sheikh Hasina government has really damaged institutions, independent institutions, including the judiciary, the National Human Rights Commission, the police. Everything had become tainted through political pressure. There needs to be a rebuilding of independent institutions. There needs to be better human rights protections. There needs to be people that have workers whose labor rights have to be protected, street children who have to be protected. I mean, there are so many communities that deserve social justice and welfare, and this is the time for Bangladesh to move forward in those directions.
Now in Europe, anti-immigrant protests and riots broke out in England following disinformation blaming immigrants for the recent deaths of three young girls. Prime Minister Keir Starmer calls it thuggery. More from Reuters' Leila Shahroshahi.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer on Sunday condemned the violent anti-immigration riots that have gripped the UK. After violent disorder swept across several cities fueled by misinformation about the murder of three young girls last week.
I utterly condemn the far-right thuggery we've seen this weekend. Be in no doubt, those that have participated in this violence will face the full force of the law. The police will be making arrests. Individuals will be held on remand. Charges will follow and convictions will follow.
False claims spread after the girls' murder that the suspect was a radical Muslim migrant. Police have said the suspect was born in Britain and are not treating it as a terrorist incident. However, protests have continued across the country, including in Liverpool, Bristol and Manchester on Saturday, resulting in arson, looting and injured police officers. On Sunday, hundreds of anti-immigration protesters gathered by a hotel near Rotherham, which Britain's Interior Minister said was housing asylum seekers. Protesters threw bricks at police and smashed hotel windows before setting a bin close to the hotel on fire. Police said one officer was knocked unconscious and others had suspected broken bones. The National Police Chiefs Council said nearly 150 people had been arrested since Saturday evening, and more would follow in the coming days. The last time violent protests erupted across Britain was in 2011, when thousands of people took to the streets after police shot dead a black man in London. Starmer was the country's chief prosecutor at that time. Community leaders and families of the victims of the murders in Southport, near Liverpool, have criticised the unrest. A group of faith leaders in Liverpool said in a joint statement that, quote, too many people have sought to use the tragedy to create division and hate.
Leila Shahroshahi of Reuters reporting for us today. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Is the world headed for an economic crisis? We'll learn more in a few minutes, but for now we'll stay in Europe. More than 29 months after the beginning of Russia's invasion, Ukrainian pilots have started flying F-16 fighter jets. The newly arrived jets were put on display Sunday by President Volodymyr Zelensky, who said the planes will boost the country's war effort against Russia. Is it also a boost for morale in war-weary Ukraine? For reaction, VOA's Lori London speaks with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
How are Ukrainians feeling about this? Are they feeling more encouraged?
So over the weekend, the first footage of F-16s was actually out and everyone have seen them in action during the presentation of the footage. And of course, people in Ukraine were waiting for this for a very long time. And all talks for the past months was about F-16s and that when F-16 arrived, this would be a big changer at the front line in the war. So people in Ukraine really have this hope that F-16 could be a really big game changer. However, a lot of experts explain to the society that, well, this is definitely a huge advantage and a very great news for Ukraine. However, people should not expect everything to change very fast and to change dramatically. And I think that this understanding is coming. So people, of course, are really happy, but at the same time are trying to keep emotions down because, as we already have seen, that neither tanks that came to Ukraine nor other equipment that was also a long-awaited equipment did not really change dramatically the things, but of course gave Ukraine additional strength, and this is what F-16 will definitely do as well. And Ukrainians hope this would be a really great combination of F-16 and other equipment that is coming to Ukraine.
And they've had some success in the last few days with their own assaults on Russia. Sounds like at least a Russian warplane and an ammunition storage facilities destroyed?
Actually, over the weekend, it was quite a successful, quite a number of successful news coming in. And one of those is that Ukrainian general staff confirmed that confirmed the attack on Morozovsk airfield in the Rostov region in Russia. And Ukrainian military reported that the ammunition warehouse was destroyed, and one of the Su-34 jets that were located there was possibly also heavily damaged. So more information and more details are still coming, and we're still waiting for the confirmation. We cannot verify this independently, but according to footage which is available, the destructions are quite significant. And also over the weekend, Ukrainian general staff confirmed the destruction of Russian submarine and also heavy damage of couple of C-400 air defense systems in Sevastopol. So over the weekend, Ukrainian forces were quite active, and even confirmation from general staff came right after the operations were implemented.
So they destroyed a submarine. That seems like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it's a huge actually, but again, not much details available, but it is confirmed that it is destroyed.
Lori London hosts Issues in the News here on The Voice of America. She was speaking with Anna Chernikova, our correspondent in Kyiv. In business news, what could very well soon become a global crisis. European stock markets joined a global sell-off on Monday morning, but seemed set to avoid the massive tumble seen in Asia, where Japan's Nikkei index lost over 12% amid fears of a possible recession in the U.S. Julian Satterthwaite of Reuters has that story.
European stocks joined a global sell-off Monday, but in calmer fashion than Asia. London's FTSE index lost around 2% from the open. The Pan-European stocks index slid a little more. Significant falls, but minor compared to the day of turmoil in Asia, where Japan's Nikkei index closed down 12.4%, That was its worst one-day decline since 1987. South Korea's KOSPI index fell close to 9%, while shares around Asia outside Japan lost a milder but still painful 4.2%. Hirofumi Kasai is senior strategist at Tokyo Marine Asset Management.
I think there is a sense of panic selling. The trigger was concerns over the US economy and prospects of interest rates rising in Japan after a more than expectedly hawkish tone from Bank of Japan Governor Ueda's news conference last week.
The stock tailspin set in last week after some worse than expected employment data in the US. That fueled fears that the country could be headed for a recession and spurred bets on rapid-fire rate cuts. Analysts at JP Morgan now say there's a 50% chance of recession in the country. The stock sell-off saw money flow into perceived safe havens instead, with the Japanese yen and Swiss franc both soaring. Adding to the gloom were weekend results from Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, which suggested the legendary investor has gone sour on stocks. He appears to have offloaded much of his holdings, including around half of his big stake in Apple. Investors saw a sign that Buffett is now wary about US economic prospects, or sky-high stock market valuations, or maybe both.
That was Reuters' Julian Satterthwaite reporting for us. And finally today, the civil war and the humanitarian crisis in Sudan continue. And as Reuters' David Doyle reports, so does the war of words.
Sudan's government on Sunday denied the existence of famine in North Darfur's Zamzam camp for internally displaced people. That contradicts the findings of a global food monitor. The Famine Review Committee said in a report on Thursday that famine, confirmed when acute malnutrition and mortality criteria are met, is ongoing in the camp and likely to persist until at least October. The finding by the Committee of Food Security Experts, linked to the globally recognized standard known as the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, is just the third time a famine classification has been made since the system was set up 20 years ago. And it comes after more than 15 months of war between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The conflict has created the world's biggest internal displacement crisis and left half the population, around 25 million people, in urgent need of humanitarian aid. Earlier this year, aid agency Médecins Sans Frontières said that one child was dying every 2 hours in the Zamzam camp. MSF said on Sunday that it only had enough therapeutic food to treat malnourished children there for another 2 weeks. But also on Sunday, Sudan's Federal Humanitarian Aid Commission said that talk of famine was inaccurate. The government body said conditions were not consistent with those that must be met to declare famine. Experts and United Nations officials say a famine classification could trigger a UN Security Council resolution, empowering agencies to deliver aid across borders to those most in need. However, Sudanese officials have said it could be a pretext for international intervention in the country. The Sudanese government blamed the Rapid Support Forces for imposing what it said was a blockade on North Darfur's capital, Al-Fasher, that has led to shortages of food and aid. The RSF on Friday declared full solidarity with the victims of the famine and repeated an offer to work with the United Nations to facilitate the delivery of aid.
Reuters' David Doyle reporting. And that wraps up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.